Melissa.
George, hello.
Hi, are you there?
Yes.
Good. So to get the formalities out of the way, I'm George Johnson, and I'm talking from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I'm speaking to Louisa Gilder in Western Massachusetts. And the occasion for the call is that Louisa has published, just in the last few months, a really, really good new book. It's called The Age of Entanglement, When Quantum Physics Was Reborn. And I'm holding up your book here so people can see it.
Great.
And it's gotten some really nice reviews, right?
Yeah, it's been so exciting.
Well, it's good. I actually pulled up a few of them here just to... That's also a good way to kind of give people a sense of what the book is like. Well, there was Don Howard in Nature.
Yeah.
Yeah, who called it a delightfully unconventional history in the form of conversations, real or constructed, among the physicists themselves. And we can get into a little later what he means by reconstructed. And then Julia Keller in Chicago Tribune called it a captivating new book. Gilder creates a movingly human and surprisingly accessible picture of the unveiling of the quantum universe, one of the most infuriating, counterintuitive, and yet crucial concepts of all times, admirably lucid. So so you have every right to be pleased with reviews like that. But, and I think probably, you know, surely most of our viewers, you know what quantum entanglement is and, you know, about the EPR paradox. But maybe in case there's some who aren't, you know, like physics junkies, you know, like we are, you could explain a little, why do you call it the age of entanglement? And is that an allusion to Edith Wharton or something?
Well, I was a tour guide at Edith Wharton's house, which is just down the road. So it was a bit inspired by her. But the age of entanglement...
But Wharton wrote Age of...
Innocence.
Innocence, right.
Yeah.
Okay, you're much more literate than I. I knew you'd know that. Okay, so Age of Entanglement.
Right, so Age of Entanglement, in a way, it's a re-looking at it, at the first half of the history is quite familiar to people who read about the history of quantum theory, but I'm sort of re-emphasizing something that I think Schrodinger and Einstein and even possibly Bohr, according to the analysis of Don Howard, would say was really the central issue that got a bit ignored and continues to get ignored in a lot of discussions of this history, which is this amazing phenomenon of entanglement, which Schrodinger described as not one but the central characteristic of quantum mechanics that enforces its entire departure from ordinary lines of thought.
Right.
And so entanglement is, and Einstein first sort of started to point it out explicitly in the 30s, and in 1935 there was a famous or infamous paper that he did with two younger colleagues that's known as the EPR paper, in which...
That was Einstein, Podolsky.
Rosen.
Or I guess Podolsky-Rosen, otherwise we'd call it the ERP paper, so...
Well, and Bohm, as a side issue, Bohm actually does always refer to another...
Oh, David Bohm. Yeah, maybe we should say...
ERP.
You know, we're talking about some of the great pioneers of quantum mechanics in the 20s, and then like Erwin Schrodinger and Niels Bohr, and people know Niels Bohr as the avuncular old Dane who was the character in Michael Frayn's play Copenhagen.
Right. I love that.
So yeah. Einstein wrote this paper with Podolsky and Rosen, and Bohm was chipping in?
He was later, but he, for some reason, Bohm always calls it the Einstein-Rosen-Podolsky, rather than, sorry, it's a very minor point.
Yeah,
order of names.
Yeah. So basically, this is the paper that journalists kind of... our shorthand for it is Einstein called entanglement spooky action at a distance.
Yeah.
And so what did he mean by that?
And Einstein was saying the quantum theory, if you take it seriously, in that the quantum theory says that quantum objects can't have properties before they're observed to have those properties, that the observation in a way creates...
So this is the idea that, like, a particle doesn't have a definite position, for example, but it's a superposition of all the different possible positions.
Yeah, and then you measure it.
And then once you measure it, it goes poof, and then it locks into one position at random.
And so Einstein was looking at this, and he said, well, this is strange because there are situations in which two particles that have once interacted and then are quite separate, when you observe or interact with one, it seems to affect the other one. Once you know what the, let's say, the position of one is, it instantly, without looking at the other one, you know what that one's, the attributes of that one. And, but you haven't touched the other one. You haven't interacted with it at all. So,
right.
So now are we saying, Einstein was saying, are we saying that by interacting with one that could be miles away, we've affected the other one that remains totally isolated and untouched?
So basically you have these two subatomic particles, and they come together in some way, and then they sort of like share the same quantum numbers or the same quantum attributes.
And share in that not that they both have the same ones, but in that they have them in common and they don't have any of their
common,
own.
So they're entangled.
They're entangled.
And so we still don't know, like, I think one way they explain this, isn't it, that like you have two particles and they can either be spinning clockwise or counterclockwise, to like just super simplify.
Right.
And
right.
Then these two particles come together, and then they're going to be, and then they go out to different sides of the universe or the galaxy, maybe, if you want to keep it closer to home. And then one of the particles is measured, and since it hasn't been measured yet, according to quantum mechanics, it's in a superposition of spinning clockwise and counterclockwise at the same time, would be a crude way to put it.
Yeah.
I'm sure some physicists will object to that
oversimplification.
But then you measure one of the particles, and it randomly collapses. The wave function collapses, as they say, and then we know that it's spinning either clockwise or counterclockwise. And the way the experiment is set up, as a result, by implication, the other particle has to be spinning in the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Because they're linked. And yet, somehow it seems a signal would have to be propagated from the first particle to the second, but this is impossible that it's a signal because it happens instantaneously, and that would mean superluminal, faster-than-light communication.
Yeah.
So if Einstein said, well, this is spooky action at a distance, so obviously there's something wrong with quantum mechanics and we need to look deeper and find the hidden mechanism.
Yeah.
So what came after that?
So after that, and there was almost dead silence to this apparently quite serious assault on, raising a big issue. And Niels Bohr did write a response paper that is universally acknowledged to be very hard to read, and very few people seem to have really tried to work out.
That was kind of typical of Bohr, wasn't it?
What's that?
That was kind of typical of Bohr, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was a little typical of Bohr. He really...
He liked to speak in these almost mystical aphorisms.
Yeah. there were definitely mystical aphorisms with Bohr, and there were also just this strong desire to not say something wrong, which sometimes results in endlessly qualifying your sentences and using incredible verbal circumlocutions to make sure. In his desperation, he wanted his words to be able to sort of stand for all time, and never to say something that, never go out on a limb and say something that could be falsified in a way.
And so it was like his very words were like a quantum haze, a quantum superposition of... And then you try to measure it to pin him down and collapse the Bohrian wave function.
Exactly. And lots of people, very careful researchers, have tried to measure and collapse the Bohr wave function.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they understand him better than I do. But the upshot of Bohr speaking in such an inaccessible way was that people decided Bohr has solved the problem, and we don't really get how, but we're just going to say that Bohr solved it, and we don't need to worry about this.
Don't need to worry about spooky action at a distance. So they kind of swept it under the rug.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And then we were mentioning David Bohm. In the late 40s, he wrote a textbook to elaborate Bohr's point of view. Mm-hmm. And in wrestling with the issue, he wrote this beautiful textbook entirely from the Bohr point of view. But by the end of it, he had become convinced that there really was something. He doesn't really betray this in the textbook, but in the writing of the textbook, he became convinced that Einstein really was onto something. There really was a problem here, and Bohm tried to construct, or did construct, a version of the quantum theory which he felt would satisfy Einstein.
I see.
And that was in 1952.
Oh, so like a couple decades later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this was also just when Bohm was also sort of in trouble for being a Marxist. And so...
Yeah, right.
So he had to kind
of... McCarthy. Yeah. McCarthy era. Yeah. I'd forgotten about that.
But, and people say, oh, poor Bohm, his career was really destroyed by the communist witch hunt of the 50s. And certainly that was not good for his career, but I really feel that what was much worse for his career was taking Einstein's argument seriously and trying to construct a version of the quantum theory that in which everything has a specific position, even if those positions are affected by spooky action at a distance. So in trying to follow up on what Einstein had sort of at the end of this EPR paper, he had said, we believe that a theory that won't have this problem is possible. And Bohm tried to produce that theory, and that theory shows even more clearly this spooky action at a distance is really vividly
there's something
happening.
Strange going on.
Yeah.
and again, wasn't I was just looking, and Bohm was born in 1917, so he was just like 20. No, he wasn't even 20. He was like a teenager when the EPR paper came out. So he's like the next generation.
Exactly.
And he's kind of coming back and saying, look, you know, this really can't be just sort of wished away.
Right.
You know, like Bohr tried to do. And then, so he's saying this really is a problem. And he, like Einstein, also really hoped to find some kind of mechanistic underpinnings, right? Hidden variables that would make quantum mechanics...
That was what Bohm was trying to do. I think it's arguable that was not what Einstein ever
wanted. Yeah, because I guess that's what you usually hear, in that Bohm was doing this like with his pilot ways, but that's probably getting into too much esoterica for... so let's hew to the storyline, and don't let me distract you. Okay, so now... So it seems pretty clear now when Bohm comes out with this that we really have to figure out an answer to how we can have spooky action at a distance. And then the next step was like the experiments, right? Like
not quite, because
okay.
So Bohm came up with this theory and was just kind of squashed and ignored, and you know, and people have various reasons for why, and it's very sociological, is my sense of it, and people just didn't want,
a lot of real mystical people have kind of latched on to Bohm, and I'm sure misunderstood him.
Well, but the reason for that is that Bohm, as he went along, as he got older, he grew farther and farther away from his hidden variables interpretation into much more mystical and philosophical and versions of the quantum theory, and he became very attached to this guru Krishnamurti.
Oh, right. So there's reasons why people...
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
But so, I haven't followed that. I don't know very much about his later thought, I have to say.
Yeah. Okay.
But so Bohm had written this paper that everyone was ignoring, and anyway, he was a Marxist, so, you know, forget it. Poor Bohm just got ignored in all directions, except by John Bell, who was quite young at the time. He was in his early 20s, and he read this paper, and he thought, wow, somebody's done it, because there had been the great John von Neumann, who essentially invented computers and invented game theory and invented and all sorts of, and was an architect of the quantum theory. He had said it was impossible to make such a hidden variables theory. So
yeah.
So it was Bell almost alone was just thrilled that someone had done it, and mm-hmm. And then he found that he sort of learned that if he got into this Bohm hidden variables theory, this theory in which quantum particles had positions but were affected by spooky action at a distance, it would be very bad for his career. So for 10 years,
yeah.
Or 12 years, he sort of set it aside. But then in 1964, he wrote a now famous paper called On the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen Paradox, mm-hmm. in which he showed that you could quantify, but the discussions, particularly Bohr's discussion, had been so qualitative, so much words and philosophical seeming, and Bell's paper showed a way, a quantitative way to look at this spooky action at a distance. And what Bell showed was you can work out the amount of correlations that are allowed between two particles in...
Yeah. This is always really one of the hardest things to explain, you know, just kind of off the top of your head. But it's like Bell's theorem.
And so what he was, it was showing that if you have a theory that's only affected by local interactions.
Yeah. So if you have like a mechanistic clockwork kind of theory,
yeah. Or,
that there's no way that this can explain
exactly
the it can explain the spooky action at a distance of entanglement.
Yeah.
So all these people were basically trying to add little bells and whistles or little hidden gears to quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
And they thought, well, if we get just the right little combinations of gears or extra ingredients or whatever metaphor you want to use, we'll be able to explain how you can have this EPR spookiness, and it won't imply weird things like instantaneous action at a distance,
right.
Particles somehow, you know, affecting each other, quote unquote, across great distances without a signal passing between them. And so we showed that this was impossible.
Yeah. You can have the gears, but you need the spooky action at a distance to make the gears work.
So and this was a, you know, when this paper came out, was it like widely hailed or?
Well, again, it was kind of ignored, and in fact its companion paper was sort of lost for 2 years and only published in 1966, and mm-hmm. and Bell, none of in the year 2000, I went to a conference of all Bell's colleagues celebrating his life, and all the ones who'd worked with him. He worked at CERN in Geneva mm-hmm. on high energy physics and quantum field theory, and all the people who worked at the accelerators with him said that during the time period that he was writing these papers, they did not know he was working on this. He kept it a secret. Mm-hmm. His secret hobby, he said, because he knew they wouldn't be interested.
Yeah.
And they would say, yeah, and we wouldn't have been interested.
So he was doing like theoretical quantum mechanics kind of on the side.
Yeah.
Like other people build boats and bottles and things.
Right.
Well, he went around his day job at the particle accelerator.
Right. So
that's great.
It took
and your book
while.
Opens with a great scene with Bell and So go on.
Just as with Bohm, almost nobody paid any attention except for one most important person, Bell. Mm-hmm. With Bell, almost nobody paid attention except for Abner Shimoni, who was a philosophy. He was a philosophy PhD who had was just getting his physics PhD, and
Yale.
And oh.
He was a classmate of Murray Gell-Mann.
Oh, no way. Oh, right,
yeah,
right,
no,
right,
he,
right,
he, not his PhD at Yale. He was an undergraduate classmate of Murray Gell-Mann.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I remember talking to Shimoni. So he kind of picked up on this.
Yes, and so someone sent him a preprint of Bell's paper because Shimoni was interested in these foundations of quantum mechanics, this secret section of physics, and Shimoni really saw how important the paper was, and not only that, he saw, he said, we've got a discrepancy between what our natural understanding of what the physical world is like, and what quantum mechanics is predicting that should be in this case of separated particles, and we should do an experiment. If you've got a discrepancy, you should do an experiment. And so he and his grad student, Mike Horn, started working on how Bell's equations apply to a very theoretical world, and Shimoni and Horn sort of brought it, came up with equations that would apply to a real experiment in a lab.
Okay, yeah, and you have a drawing of that experiment in your book.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a great drawing. And so basically, then to encapsulate the experiment, it's basically an experiment then that would test Bell's theorem.
Yeah, see if...
Bell's idea that it's impossible to explain the EPR effect with any kind of localized mechanistic theory that doesn't violate locality.
Yeah.
And violating locality means that you can have these spooky connections across distances.
Yeah.
Okay.
And meanwhile, there was one other person who had come across Bell's paper, and that was John Clauser, and he was doing the same thing as Shimoni and Horn. And so they all got together to... And so at this moment, still nobody... It's still... My whole book... Until about 2000, or really until 1991, the whole subject was just continually shoved aside, and people who focused on it were, a bit on the fringe, or considered it. The history of entanglement is mostly a history of people who were ignored or sort of, and issues that were a bit swept under the rug. So it's sort of a funny history.
Yeah. And what did the experiment show?
And the experiment indeed showed that these particles were somehow, demonstrating correlations that were not explicable by local, realistic, separable explanations.
I was rereading parts of your book the other night, and there's this nice section early on where you really explain Bell's theorem and the implications just very clearly, and it was based on a paper by a scientist named David Merriman.
Right.
Yeah, and he imagined this kind of this imaginary machine that you're walking across the heath or something instead of finding like a clock like in the in the famous. What was that bishop's name?
Right.
But anyway, instead of you're walking across the heath and you find this strange little machine with some dials that you can tweak and some lights, that go on with different colors, and you play around with it, and you have no idea how it's built. It's a black box,
right?
And you tweak the dials and you see how the lights are blinking on and off, and you gather all these statistics on it. And then when you're done, you realize that there's no possible clockwork that you could come up with that's inside that box that would explain the pattern of its behavior.
Yeah.
So it's just some kind of weird... Until I read that, I'm not sure I ever... That section in your book, I'm not sure I ever really understood Bell's theorem. I doubt that I really understand it now, but I really then got... a feel for it in a way that I hadn't before.
And that paper, Merriman's paper was called Quantum Mysteries for Anyone, and I highly recommend it to anyone who might be interested. I mean, it's just one of the best papers I've ever read. It's just so, it is so mysterious, and it really invites you, the reader, to try to work it out. And he does it, he's worked out a way to tell to describe the correlations without using math, so that makes it more accessible to more people. And that it's just a magical paper that just makes you think, wow, and the world really is constructed in such a way, and we can't explain it.
And that's what this all really leads up to, the finally the experiments showing that you can't refute Bell's theorem, that something spooky has to be going on.
Yeah, whatever it might be. And there are all sorts of explanations. A lot of people, and a lot of people that I really respect, say the answer is that the world is really non-local, that there really are...
Yeah.
And then a lot of other physicists that I respect say, no, quantum mechanics is still local. It's that there's something unreal, or there's something going forwards and backwards in time. That was one of Feynman's. So there's all these different explanations.
And that's where you get, there's always that hard leap where you have the equations and the mathematics, and they say something, you know, very distinct. And then there's the leap over how you go from the mathematics to interpretations, and then there's all kinds of conflicting interpretations.
Right.
I remember once a physicist that I was interviewing referred to that as the word problem. And we were talking about decoherence, which is one of the interpretations of the collapse of the quantum wave, but not to get into that. And then I was asking him, well, you know, so what does this mean? That, and he goes, oh, well, then we're getting into the word problem. So it's interesting to me, this idea that basically there's no reason to believe that our brains, you know, which evolved on the Earth to catch prey and avoid being prey, that we would develop the mental architecture that would allow us to understand a subatomic world that's really kind of sealed off to us and operates as a black box. It's sort of like a character in a video game isn't necessarily going to evolve the ability to understand the machine code of the computer that it's running on.
And I guess the thing is that it's been amazing how much humans have understood of the world so far. And so we think, oh wow, well we've gotten this far, so it's hard to say why it's adaptive that we should be able to understand Newtonian physics even. Though but to be able to understand the planets and their courses seems like
it's amazing how far we've gone, and yet every once in a while you'll get to this point where you're up against a kind of this wall or membrane or something, and you think if you keep pushing you'll probably get deeper through, but you never know if you're going to just finally hit a wall where the brain just can't comprehend that. And that mystery comes out so nicely in your book, and I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of the nature of the book. It's written in this really interesting way that's unusual for a book about science and a book about the history of science, because this starts way back with Planck in 1900 and the very roots of quantum mechanics, and some of these just wonderful characters like Werner Heisenberg and Bohr and Erwin Schrödinger and Wolfgang Pauli, who signed his letters the Wrath of God. I remember my favorite story about Pauli was, I think when he was a student, and this distinguished scientist is giving a lecture.
It was Einstein.
And he says, well, you know what Professor Einstein has to say is really not so stupid. Pauli was great, but you bring that whole history to life in this really interesting way, and I just wanted to read this really funny line from, there's a review in the Washington Post by the physicist James Treffel.
Right.
And it's like, he really liked the book, and then he's saying, I'm sure this will give historians fits, and he's talking about your methodology of reconstructed conversations between scientists. So he's saying, I'm sure this will get historians fits, but aside from some stilted language, it worked for me.
I love that.
By stilted language, he means the conversations like between Bohr and these people, which probably were pretty stilted at times. It also kind of wild. But anyway, what does he mean by reconstructed? I mean, I know what he means because I You know, I read the book and you explain your methodology right up front. But why don't you talk about that a little?
What I did, and it was something that I sort of settled on about 2 years into working on the book, and I was trying to explain entanglement in its historical as it evolved, as our understanding of it evolved in the historical setting, and it just seemed that our understanding of it was so affected that the roots that people tried to explore and the roots that people considered that they shouldn't try to explore were so affected by sociological forces, and in fact, in personal reasons, the things that the prestige of Bohr, for example, and what people understood Bohr to be saying led a lot of people to say, following the course that Einstein or Schrödinger has suggested was important, which would involve let's find out what's going on with entanglement. People understood Bohr to be saying, no, don't go there. And there was this wonderful quote from Heisenberg Heisenberg writes this autobiography of his intellect, which is all these reconstructed conversations, which of course people are always, you know, saying, well, you know, he didn't remember that right, or he didn't remember the other thing right, but anyway, yeah. But he was reconstructing his intellectual life, and he writes at the beginning the reason for doing this is that he says science is based on conversations, and I was thinking about that quote and about
science is based on conversations,
and it seemed that there was no normal historian style way of writing the story of entanglement without without taking into account the fact that conversations were really important in how it developed and how it didn't develop.
Mm-hmm.
And also a lot of popular books on the subject either raise Einstein's point of view as the perfect... Einstein was great and Bohr was some sort of awful person for... Bohr was wonderful, and Einstein was sort of this senile Einstein.
Yeah, right. He wouldn't accept quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's the stereotype.
And both of these, the more common one is saying Einstein went senile, but the smaller group says Bohr was a horrible person. And I feel that neither of these sort of stereotypes, which are what come out very normally in writing about this subject. Neither of these stereotypes can convey what really happened, because Einstein and Bohr were really good friends who really admired each other all through their lives. And
there was just this constant interaction
of both
being on the same side of trying to understand what in the world is going on down there.
And so anyway, so all this led me... I realize I got off the... taking the long route to explain why I... reconstructed these conversations, and it was that I felt that the story really couldn't be understood without a nod towards the fact that this is humans interacting.
No, it just works beautifully, like from the very beginning, like where you're suddenly, you open the book and you're reading about this character, John Bell, and this colleague named Bertelsmann, and they have this interesting interaction involving socks, Bertelmann socks, and just from the moment on, you know, you're going, it's not all conversations by any means, but you're going from one scene to another. Like you have in one of my favorites, you have Wolfgang Pauli and is it Heisenberg at the movie theater?
Yeah,
and they're watching
Charlie Chaplin
film.
Fans. Yeah,
and they come out and they're talking about Chaplin. About some skit that he does, and they describe it as a perfect schwindle, a perfect swindle. And then this idea of a swindle, like a trick, I guess, comes up again and again
Heisenberg
in the book.
And they're
using it in their own conversations to describe quantum, the various tentative quantum theories, right?
Yeah.
Or interpretations.
They in all these, and so that, for example, and that conversation, I pulled what Pauli and Heisenberg are saying to each other. I pulled out of their letters from that time period, the meeting, that the scene is based on the fact that I think it was Heisenberg wrote Bohr and said, well, I met Pauli in Munich on January, whenever it was, and this is what we talked about. And then, so what in the book, what the reader of my book is reading is quotes from Heisenberg and Pauli's letters and a bit from Bohr when they quote Bohr. And mm-hmm. So it's a conversation constructed almost entirely out of their real words, but obviously right. not, you know, I may have completely missed what they really said that day, but it's using words that they certainly
level best guess of what they could have been talking about based on what they were writing at the time to each other, and all these, you know, there's just this wonderful literature of letters that has fortunately been preserved, and what they were saying at conferences recorded. And so that's what I really liked, how you just explained up front that this is what you're going to do, and that obviously this has some risks, but you figure the payoffs are better than the risks, which I think you've definitely shown to be true. And what I also like is whenever I found myself thinking like, wow, I wonder where she got that, I could just go back into your very detailed, extensive notes section and find out what, you know, where the bits and pieces came from that you put together.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's nice. And I really like, you have the same kind of, I think, obsession that I have for having these really detailed notes sections where the
right.
the notes threaten to be longer than the text of the book. I like that. So that's the conversations. And I thought it'd be fun, too, to just kind of step back and talk about the process of writing one's first book and writing a book about science. Because at this point, someone listening to the conversation might think that you were a physicist. and from talking to you before, I know that we both had sort of the same kind of checkered pasts.
Exactly.
We both thought we wanted to be physicists, and then when we saw what that actually entailed. And I know for me it was, growing up reading George Gamow and, his book, there was 1, 2, 3...
Infinity.
And there was the 30 Years That Shook Physics.
Which is one of my all-time favorite books.
Wonderful. And Gamow, for those who don't know, was, one of the great early physicists.
Yeah,
Hungarian.
Yeah.
And
Russian.
Yeah. Russian, was he?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. He was Russian. Von Neumann was Hungarian. And Szilard was Hungarian.
There's a pile of Hungarians.
Yeah. Gamow. Yeah. Gamow. But anyway, so, reading books like that or this nice book about Einstein by Lincoln Kaplan, I think.
Oh,
The Universe and Mr. Einstein or Universe and Dr. Einstein. Oh, there's all kinds of this. There's just all this wonderful or wonderful, just popular literature floating around that I just immersed myself in, and I thought, wow, I want to get to college and learn about quantum mechanics and relativity. And
exactly.
Then you get to, course number one, and you're starting out in, with Newtonian mechanics in the 17th century.
And there's sort of problems about Mary and Jane pulling a sled up a hill.
Oh, yeah, and they're not as easy as... one I remember is, involved, frictionless tracks, and then they would have a loop, and you would have to compute, the momentum of the ball when it's at the top of the loop. And there usually, if you had an insight into the structure of the problem, there would be some interestingly trivial explanation. Like, I remember when I was taking this physics class from Victor Regener, who was this wonderful German, second-generation German, I guess, physics professor at my University of New Mexico. And I was taking the test, and there was this word problem that he gave us, and then we had to do calculations. And he was describing launching a missile from Earth, and then, you had to plot the parabolic trajectory. And then the question was, how far would it go before it fell back to Earth again?
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there grinding away and doing this stuff, then it's fallen this far, but it's already moved this far, and the Earth is curved under it by the exact same amount. And then suddenly I realize it's going into orbit. So this is what, you know, so I really had this wonderful insight, which is one of the few wonderful insights that I had while I was taking a test. So I changed my major the next semester, I think, to modern European literature or something. So that was a long tangent, but what was your story?
Well, but my story is so similar. And I went to college wanting to be a physics major, and about 2 years into it, I just thought everyone else is so much faster, and I can't do these problems quickly, and each problem set is agony. And actually, I don't think I was overestimating how smart my classmates were, but probably they were having a harder time than I thought.
Yeah,
But I was just a lot slower, and I began to think, this is silly. I should do something I'm good at, not something I'm bad at. Mm. And I switched to English literature.
So you probably also at this point had good feedback about your writing and.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, because you know you can tell from your book you're just a natural writer, real prose stylist.
I always like to write, and so even as I was going to college, people were saying, "Well, why physics? Because it's so cool, it's so amazing."
Okay, so how did you get then from changing from physics to literature, and then suddenly you're immersing yourself in the foundations of quantum mechanics and its history?
So I after 2 years of physics, I left it behind, became an English literature major, but I had some distributive requirements to fulfill, and one of them was philosophy, and so I took a philosophy of science class, mm-hmm. in which I was given that wonderful paper by David Merman about called Quantum Mysteries for Anyone.
An undergraduate philosophy of science class. That's wonderful.
It was just wonderful, and I think every single philosophy class and physics class should be given this paper to read, because it's only 7 pages long, and it's just so accessible and yet so deeply mysterious. And I thought, I do love physics. Look at this. This paper is so magical. I worked out that the physics department had this wonderful thing where they let you do an independent study for 2 terms with a professor, mm-hmm. Who is just your professor, and you move at whatever pace you can handle. And,
even if you're not a physics major.
It was just amazing. I went crawling back to the physics department, and they set me up with a new professor, who I kind of think they pawned me off. They're like, we got this English major,
oh,
who wants to write
English
about integer.
Out there in the hallway, and she wants to do an independent study on the foundations of quantum mechanics. You take her.
But luckily, it was Miles Blanco, who was just wonderful, and we had such a great time those 2 terms. And he taught me the quantum mechanics of entanglement, and he had known a little bit about this history that you and I were just talking mm-hmm. about, but sort of guided me to learn more. And together we were learning more and more about this fascinating history and how much the history had impinged on. And we both got really excited about it.
Oh, that's great!
It was so
wonderful.
You were
just reading like mad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then in my senior spring, he invited Shimoni to come give a talk at Dartmouth.
Oh, right.
And so that was great, and we got to meet Shimoni.
Yeah. And so this all resulted then in kind of is it like a senior thesis type thing?
Kind of. It wasn't. I was a physics minor, and so it was. I don't know what they called it, but it was a long paper at any rate.
So you did get a minor in physics.
I did.
That's great. Not many people get a major in literature and a minor in physics. I love these cross-disciplinary things.
Me too.
I
mean, yeah.
There's just so little of that anymore. You know, people treat college like trade school.
Yeah, yeah. But at least American. I mean, my sister went to school in Scotland, and her friends going to school in England. Mm-hmm. You pick your major right at the beginning, and
really?
If you want to switch, you got to start at the beginning again.
Oh, so it's more like that.
Yeah, wow. So America, in a way, it's, even though I agree with you that people get very specialized.
They don't have to.
They don't have to, yeah.
Mm. That's interesting. So now this was the year 2000, right? You graduated from college.
Right.
And now you had this project that you'd written, like, what, you know, a few dozen pages maybe? And
it was 50 pages.
50 pages. And you decided to do a book.
Yeah, it just, there was so much material. I felt that the more I dug, the more interesting it got, and the more complicated and the more surprises there were. And Entanglement was still so beautiful even after studying it. The mystery didn't dissipate with greater understanding, even though it wasn't, my understanding wasn't that great. But
oh, well, yeah, sure.
So I started writing the book, and which was definitely facilitated by getting a house sitting job.
Yeah,
so that was
right. So you mentioned this to me once. You got a house sitting job in California, right?
Yeah, yeah.
In the Berkeley Hills, or
yeah, in the Oakland Hills.
Oakland Hills, and so basically, someone that said, you know, we're going to, you know, on a long extended trip, and you can live in our house for free, and write.
Exactly. Yeah.
So that's good. That's just what a writer needs on his first book, you know. It's like first free rent. And plus, you're right there in the area of Berkeley.
Right, where the first experiment of Entanglement was done. So it was a perfect, it was an incredible location.
So at this point, your research, your historical research, which involved reading books and letters, was combined with more a journalistic approach, where you were actually going out and finding people who remembered those early days and participated in the early days.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that was really, really fun. There were so many amazing people involved,
uh-huh.
and there were some funny the main thing Shimoni said to me is, if you're going to write this book, you must find John Clauser, mm-hmm. who is the one who did this first experiment with Stuart Friedman at Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
And you must find Clauser because popular accounts of this always underrate what Clauser did.
Mm-hmm.
And Clauser was one of the first to recognize how important what Bell did was, and he, with Shimoni and Horn and Holt, worked out a way to bring Bell's equation into the lab, and then he went and did the experiment. And so I went looking for Clauser, and I went to Berkeley, and everybody said, Clauser, he's a funny guy. We haven't heard from him in a long time. And I went on the internet, and there was Clauser living a couple towns away.
Oh. It wasn't so hard to find after all.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you called him up?
Yeah, and so I called him up, but after everybody said, oh, he's a bit of a... He's a tough guy. People kind of scared me, and so I felt that I... had to endear myself to him, and I knew that he was a yachtsman.
Uh-huh.
Is that the word? And so I said, "Oh well, I've sailed boats," and which was true that I had sailed rowboat dinghies with a little sail on a tiny pond.
Yeah, a boat is a boat.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And so he said, "Great, because my wife is crewing in this women's skipper's race, and she's got me and eight other people as crew, but we need one more person."
Yikes.
So great. So you come along and you be part of the crew, and you can interview me as we sail the boat back up to its dock in Alameda.
And you use that scene of being on the sailboat with this guy in your book.
I think that ultimately it didn't make it into the book.
Into the final. Yeah, we'll talk about
final.
That a little later, because I was lucky enough to get in on... Not in on the creation, but not too many years after that.
Right, exactly.
An early form of the book.
Yeah.
So you had a lot of fun doing this too, which is.
Yeah, it was so fun.
Yeah. Just immersed. There's nothing I love more than that feeling of just being immersed in a project, a book you're writing, where it's, you know, every day you get up and live with it, and.
And the more you learn, the more fascinating it is. That's an amazing experience.
Now, were you already writing at this point, or just researching?
Yes, I was. My father had kind of said to me, "You got to do lots and lots of research. But if you only do research and don't write, it's so easy. There's so many interesting things to learn that it's so easy to go off on tangents."
You've got to just start right off. And we should mention your father's a writer.
Yeah, as is my mother and many of my ancestors. So
it's a Gilbert tradition.
Yeah,
and some of our listeners, probably many of our listeners, will know of your father, George Gilder.
Yeah,
and his writing about technology. So he had quite a few books under his belt at that point. So
yeah, so
that'd be that'd be great. I mean, how many people can go to their father for advice on, you know, writing their first book?
And I don't know how people who, well, how did you do it? Your parents are not writers,
no,
are they?
No, they're not. My father was a doctor, and he's no longer alive, and my mother was a teacher.
Yeah.
But I was always, you know, just very, we had a very, you know, we were just people reading all the time at my house.
Yeah.
So I was, you know, I just loved books from the very beginning.
Yeah.
But I was really struck by what you said about how you have to start writing right away. Like when I was writing Strange Beauty, this biography of Murray Gell-Mann.
Yeah.
Ebner Shimony's, not roommate, but classmate.
Right.
At Yale. And Shimony was one of my great sources. But I started out just researching the very early, early days of Gell-Mann's life. And I found, you know, where he went to school, elementary school.
Yeah. Yeah.
In New York, and then went there and found whatever records they had and tried to find old classmates and was pretty lucky finding them. But, yeah, and I found as soon as I was ready, I had to just sit down and come up with the first chapter of Gell-Mann's early life. And then I moved on to his days at Yale. And of course, when you do this, you're going to find something like a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road, and then you're going to have to go back and change something
you've
written. So it's constantly in flux. And, you know, everything.
But if you didn't write down, for example, Murray Gell-Mann's elementary school years right away after researching them, then all the subtleties that you didn't even think to write down as a note, but something about interviewing one of those classmates or something.
Or you'll learn something later about his life, and it'll just kind of go back to that. And then you can go back in your manuscript and sort of foreshadow that.
Right,
And then hopefully the reader will, you know, when they read that, it'll go into some sort of, midterm memory register. And then when they get later to the book, you know, you will have kind of planted the seed and then exploded it 50 pages later. And it looks like this is all done seamlessly, but of course you're jumping back to the beginning as you learn something and recreating the first chapter. And it's just such a great...
And sometimes tearing things totally to pieces that you worked on for years.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, I tried to estimate once, guesstimate how many times any particular book, how many times I'd probably read through one page, and it's hundreds by the time you're done. And you're fact-checking, you're going through and saying, wait, where did this come from? And then you're going back and checking again and saying, oh, yeah, or else finding you got it wrong. And then you're finding like five or six physicists to read the manuscript and see if you see what they can uncover. And
pray that they don't disagree too much on where you went wrong.
But if they do, then you have to think, well, do I stand by my interpretation here or not? And it's just this great process. And at some point, was it around 2003, you'd come up with a very complete, polished, but a big manuscript.
A long thing.
And I'm going to hold it up here because this is where I come in and play a bit part in the story. So
starring role.
I'll give my recollection.
Okay.
I just got an email one day from a New York Times colleague named Jim Brook. Or James Brook, who was a foreign correspondent, and then I knew him when he was the Denver bureau chief of the New York Times, or they call it the Rocky Mountain bureau chief of the New York Times, and I was already in Santa Fe then, having left New York, and in addition to writing for Science Times and the Week in Review, I also actually had a contract with the National Desk, so occasionally I went out and did stories about interesting, quirky New Mexico things, And Jim was down here working on something he didn't mention it to me then, but we got to know each other well enough that a short time later I got an email from him, and he said that he was visiting his niece, Louisa Gilder, and that she was writing this book on the history of quantum mechanics or something like that, and he wasn't sure, you know, he completely, you know, wasn't one of his subjects, and that he'd seen two of my books on your shelves, which I think was probably Strange Beauty and maybe A Shortcut Through Time.
Shortcut Through Time,
book about quantum computing, and I, you know, of course, I was just immediately flattered. You know, it's just always wonderful to hear that someone actually has your books on their shelves, and sometimes you wonder if these things just, you know, fall into a black hole. So, you know, so I was obviously predisposed to go on, and then he asked me if I would read the manuscript. And I said, well, sure. So he sent it to me, and then, you know, this 10-pound...
You probably didn't say, sure, you would read it. You probably said, sure, I'll look at it.
Yeah, look at it. Because, you know, because it's difficult when someone is a friend.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so... and then later I found out that James Brooks is Uncle Jimmy in your family. And so I got this 443 single-spaced manuscript with pretty tiny type.
Yeah.
And this would be like maybe a 12, 15, I don't know, 1,200-word book, or maybe it could be done in three volumes, like, you know, like Schlesinger's Age of Roosevelt. But, you know, and then I was really struck by the picture on the cover, and there's all these really nice sketches of the protagonists in the story of the quantum, and then I realized, looking into it, that you did these drawings. And I was really glad to see that they survived into the Knopf edition.
Yeah.
But at this point, you know, I just started reading, and, you know, again, I'm apprehensive. What am I going to tell Jim Brook if I, you know, think it's, you know, not readable or something? But I just start reading, and the first chapter is called The Socks. And this has probably changed, but it says The Socks. And it says, sitting up in the little computer room is a man working, a postdoc here at the University of Vienna. The IBM machine takes up a good part of the room, 15 feet in this direction, 6 feet high, 6 feet wide. And it just goes on and on into this narrative, and at some point this character named Bertelmann, you know, comes bursting into the room. And it just, you know, it was like I was reading the story. And I just, yeah, you know, went on and on, and I got, you know, into... Heisenberg and Polly at the movie, and going back and looking in the notes, and I was just really captivated, and you know, I got in, you know, I think like a couple hundred pages, and then, you know, like you would expect, the later parts of the book were a little more diffuse and sprawling, and obviously needed some focus, and at this point, I guess, I don't know, had you approached any publishers?
No, because I had not. I wasn't sure what I was doing at the point that I had that manuscript.
Yeah.
I think I wasn't even really brave enough to be thinking quite in terms of publishers, and was more thinking, oh, I want to get the guys that are in it to read it and tell me where I made my mistakes, yeah, and that sort of thing. And I, on my side, was horrified when my Uncle Jimmy said, oh, I gave the book to George Johnson.
Oh
no, he's going to get this huge manuscript, and it's just one of those annoying things that...
Oh, no, I mean, it was great, and yeah, and then at that point, I was impressed, and I told John Siegel, who's my editor at Knopf, that, you know, this is this really great thing, and I think you should really, really look at it, and don't be alarmed when it arrives, you know, because it's not going to be, you know, the usual double-spaced thing in a large manila envelope, but it's, and, you know, he started reading it and, you know, agreed you had a good book there, and I guess was really instrumental in helping you wrestle it into shape. And
yeah.
He's one of those rare editors that, it's just so hard to find editors who actually still edit. And John, you know, he's really good. He'll take something home and immerse himself in it and tell you where it's not hanging together and where it doesn't make sense. And the rest, you know, the result emerges how many years later after that? Another five years.
5 years after that, yeah.
Wow. And then this book comes out. You know, there's actually easier ways. I just realized we've almost gone an hour.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was so fun. I was like, you know, I sent you the piece. You know, there's much easier ways to do this now in the modern day of the internet, writing books. And there was a piece in the Times recently about the self-publishing phenomenon is really taking off. And instead of trying to find a publisher, you can just pay one.
Right.
To publish your books, and then it's you download them on demand. So it's kind of like the whole idea of the vanity press that's come into the computer age. And you know, and I read that and I thought, well, that sounds good, because you know, in some cases, you know, it can be unfairly hard for a good book to find a publisher, and this way you might, you know, you can get something out. And there's been a few rare cases where, you know, these things did well on the sales because they had a natural audience, and then a real publisher picked them up, you know, the kind that pay you money instead of you paying them. And so I thought that was really interesting. But then there was this really alarming twist that I came across yesterday, this article in the Boston Globe by Alex Beam. And, you know, the next big thing is you have to get people to give you blurbs for your book, right? And now there's some site, I don't know what, if it's called Blurbmeister, Blurb Machine or something, blurbings.com, and they'll get you 10 blurbs for free. Oh, for free. Oh, okay. Well, if it's free, I guess it's not so bad, but it's a little seems.
It does say for free?
I think it says for free, and then they plant a tree. Oh, I see. They'll get you the blurbs for free, plus they promise to plant a tree if you do business with them, to offset your carbon footprint, I guess. Anyway, I think it's more complicated than free. But that's just one. But then the really hard part is the book comes out and you wait in agony for reviews.
For those reviews.
But, you know, not to fear. Now you can go to reviewyourbook.com or bookreview.com and you can pay for reviews. And someone will write you a review. And one of them says that, you know, these reviews are very, very objective, and, you know, we tell it like it is, but if it's a bad review, we won't post it on
the site. We just won't post it,
I'm not sure if you still get charged for it then or not. And then you can do online book signings, et cetera, et cetera. So it's much harder doing it the way you did, I think, and there's certain things to be said for having editors. And
yeah. In fact, now that now having gone through the editorial process, I keep on reading books. I think, oh, this is such a good book. If only an editor had really focused on it, it would be a great book.
Yeah, and so often they don't. They just cut them loose.
And you feel that with books that content is wonderful, but it just wasn't sharpened or it wasn't.
It's just so hard, you know, writing books, and it's what's hard too is, you know, going back and reading your own books after they're published.
Yeah.
You know, and sometimes, you know, you'll be, well, you know, two things might happen. If it's a book you wrote several years ago, you go, wow, I was really much better back then. Or else you'll read something that you wrote several years ago and you'll go, oh, God, that is so clunky. You know, that sentence, and I would never do that now, so. And but you know, it's kind of set in concrete at that point,
right? Though as you've been telling me, it is nice how you can put up a website and have you can make notes on what you'd like to change about your book. That in this age, it is a little bit less set in concrete.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, the errata. Because I mean, the way it always has been, you know, there's going to be errors you make in the first printing. And then the publisher corrects them in the second printing.
But, yeah.
You know, now you can actually, you know, go to put something on your website, you know, if you make a mistake or an errata sheet. And I think that's going to, you know, that's a good thing. Plus you can add, one thing you could do is, that I've noticed some publishers are doing, if they don't want to pay for all the ink to do the full notes and bibliography section, they get the author to put it on the web.
Just have that on the web.
I have mixed feelings about that. Yeah. I kind of feel like that should be there with the book. But your notes were...
I kind of think so too.
You had to cut back your notes quite a bit, didn't you?
Yeah.
So that would be something you could do on your website is go put the... put a...
Put the other notes on.
Yeah, deeper version of the notes. Yeah. So it's kind of nice, like through having a website, a book can become more of a living document.
Yeah.
So I think you know, it's that kind of symbiosis between, you know, print and cyber print that's, you know, really, really where the good lies. Well, we might as well talk a few more minutes. You know, some people go on sometimes for an hour and 10 minutes, but because I really wanted to ask you about, you know, and this is the section we'll call Entanglement in the News.
Right.
Now, you know, what we're talking about, you know, sounds maybe very philosophical and esoteric, although anyone reading your book will see that it's far more than that, and certainly will be much clearer. But there was a story in the Times recently that my old colleague Ken Chang wrote about an experiment that involved entanglement and what they call in quantum mechanics teleportation.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you could give me your take on that. And we'll link to the paper later, so under
great,
the
great,
article.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so exciting. This teleportation that they talk about, it is kind of a sensational name, and because what's being teleported is not matter, but the state that the matter is in.
Is this right that basically in quantum mechanics a particle is not only described by its quantum numbers, but in a way you could say that it is its quantum numbers?
Yeah, I mean...
And then you have this cluster of information, and if you can transfer this to another particle, it's basically the same thing as creating the same particle at a distance.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what they mean by teleporting it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And because all those subatomic particles are indistinguishable except for their essence.
Difference between, like, two electrons are identical except that they're in different positions in space.
And so it's those things about those attributes that are the only interesting thing about them, and if you put those attributes on a different electron, it essentially becomes the previous one.
Yeah, so it's like teleportation in Star Trek, except you're only doing it with one particle instead of all of the interacting particles
that make up a human being.
Yeah, have to go back to Lawrence Krauss's Physics of Star Trek and see what he says about the parallels or divergences there. But this, what was exciting about this new paper? It was they used entanglement basically.
Yes, would you
to
have
entangle
to do
two particles and basically teleport the characteristics of one onto the other?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the beautiful thing that they did before teleportation had been done between photons, particles of light, or between two ions that were very close together.
Mm-hmm.
But this, they had their ions a meter apart, which is a big distance for these little guys, and the way they did it, and it involves this thing that I just think is so beautiful, which is called entanglement swapping, where each ion emits a photon, and so each ion is entangled with its own photon. But then, when the two photons entangle, they lose their entanglement with their ions, but it causes the two ions to be entangled at a distance.
Oh.
So the entanglement swaps from being one ion entangled with its photon and the other ion being entangled with its photon to entanglement between the two photons and entanglement between the two ions, which have never met. So for...
So wait, let me see if I got that.
Yeah.
So in the classic entanglement experiments that we've been talking about, the two particles are in contact, and then they go apart, and then they're entangled and have this strange entangled connection.
Yeah.
And in this case, the particles start out being a meter apart, but they emit photons,
and the photons interact,
and then that ends up causing an entanglement between these two particles that are just sitting there minding their own business.
Okay. Yeah. And
that's so new. Okay.
And that itself isn't super new. It had been done before, but now, I'm not sure if with exactly this configuration. I think this configuration is unique to this group of Christopher Monroe and the University of, I guess they started at Michigan and now they're at Maryland.
Yeah, I guess Monroe moved again. When I was in contact, and he was up at the National Institute of Standards and Technology north of here in Boulder.
Oh.
He's really one of the top quantum computing this is involved in, because the idea is that this kind of entanglement might be used to create connections inside a quantum computer.
Yeah.
I mean, connections, quote unquote.
Whatever they are.
Whatever they are, entanglements. Yeah.
And so from a computing standpoint, this setup is great because the ions work well as a memory, because they can be held in one place for quite a long time, and they hold their quantum state. But the photons work well to transmit, to establish entanglement over distances. Mm-hmm. So they're using each kind of particle for what it's best at.
God, that's great stuff. It made some progress in quantum computing. When I wrote this book, A Shortcut Through Time, about quantum computing, and at this point, there's this idea in quantum computing, where instead of bits in a computer that are one or zero, that you have qubits, spelled Q-U-B-I-T-S, but of course, alluding back to the old ancient qubit with the C. But the idea that with a qubit, with a Q, you can have one and zero in quantum superpositions, and this can allow you to solve problems that are intractable for a classical computer. And I remember at the time I wrote the book, the record number of qubits, you can also think of them as the basic computing components in a quantum computer. And people had made quantum computers with 7 qubits then, and that was the record.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I went up to Los Alamos and watched an experiment where they did this. And then I think since then, this book came out, I think, in 2003. And since then, they've gotten all the way up to 10 qubits, officially. But then there's this company that has been in the, I guess it's been in the news, or at least in a corner of the science news recently, called D-Wave in Canada, that claims to have made a 128-qubit computer. But it's very controversial because, for one thing, it's a private company, so we don't, there's not this access to the research that there would be in a university lab, which seems a shame. But then again, maybe it's the only way to get it done. But there's also this controversy of whether the computer is actually doing quantum computing, and how would you know if it's not just doing classical computing, with some exotic setup. They make DNA computers and all kinds of esoteric laboratory computers, and I guess the big question now is whether it's really doing quantum computing. So.
Yeah.
So we can link to that.
Yeah.
Because that's another. We could do a. Maybe we should come back and do another show on that sometime.
once we understand it better.
Because it's interesting, and there was some good stuff about the. There's even one of these SETI at home type things where you can download software to help them work on some sort
proving
of classical algorithm. That's what was that? It's a classical algorithm that's going to calculate what the statistics should be for solving this problem quantum mechanically.
If they were really doing
it
quantum mechanically.
And I'm still, we were emailing about this.
Right.
I'm still confused, since the whole idea is that a quantum computer can do what you can't do classically, but somehow you can classically simulate one to the extent of getting statistics. So I don't know. We need to get Seth Lloyd on here.
I'm going to see him really soon, actually. So I'll ask him.
That's right. Seth is also he's related.
His grandmother lived in Terringham, which is my tiny little hometown.
Right. Yeah, Seth's a great guy.
Yeah.
Well, good. I guess we should probably wrap it up. And it takes us up to 73 minutes and 11, 12, 13 seconds. So it was good talking to you.
It was great talking with you.
Wow,
George.
And okay, fingers crossed for more good reviews.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I think Merman's going to review it in The American Scientist.
Excellent.
So.
Excellent. Wow. Well, that'll be good because you'll get a really good audience there.
Yeah.
Okay, Louisa.
Great.
Okay, bye.